Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second episode of the Frontend Greatness Podcast. I'm your host, AP Koponen, and this is a podcast that helps frontend developers go from good to great. Our today's topic is called Automate All the Things. And my guest is James Elderfield. Hi, James.
Hi, AP. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, welcome. So can you briefly tell us who you are and what you do?
Sure. So I'm a software engineer at Supermetrics. I mainly work on the front end part of our products, so writing a lot of TypeScript and React. Before this, I actually was a DevOps consultant. And before that, I was a research scientist. So the topic of automation is something that's really dear to my heart, as it saved me so many hours of work over the years.
And you actually, the reason why I asked you to talk about this topic also was that you won an internal award at Supermetrics. So we have an award called the Main Funk Award. And at the last engineering all hands, it was given to you. So for the purposes of this podcast, I will call you an award-winning automation specialist.
Yeah, sounds good. I mean, you can do that forever if you like.
Yeah, sure. That's your new nickname. So I think that we can start out with like kind of the motivation, like why this topic is, you know, why should anyone care? So James, why should you automate stuff on the front end?
There are so many different reasons, right? It's I guess we can start with the sort of the more obvious ones. Is just the fact that the tasks you automate are generally boring, they're normally repetitive, and they take a lot of time. And in the end, as we've discussed before in the past, you and I, that you have a finite amount of mental effort to expend in any one day. So if you spend 10% of that mental effort doing tasks that could have been automated, that 10% can't be used for anything that actually requires some actual imagination and creativity. So I think that's kind of the simplest one, is just the fact that, yeah, why waste your brain thinking about stuff that could be automated? Save it for tougher, more interesting tasks.
Yeah. I also think that, like, the one thing is that, like, a lot of, like at least the previous version of me, like few of years past, I used to think that I can handle like all the manual stuff, that, you know, it's possible for me to somehow, you know, that I shouldn't care about automating stuff. But then, like, over time, I've started to kind of realize that productivity in many ways is all about those small gains that you gain over time. So getting rid of the craft, or the, you know, and also I think we as human beings are not really good at, you know, automating stuff, like following step-by-step things. People start skipping them and then you get errors and stuff like that. So, you know, things that computers do well, we do often quite badly.
I think that's a good point. So basically, the only way to, if you have a repetitive task and you need it to consistently be done well, basically the accepted best way of doing this is to write a checklist. You know, this is what they do when you're starting a plane up, or you're starting up another vehicle. You have a checklist you work your way through to do something that is just mechanical and has a step-by-step process. But at the point where you've written a checklist, you now have a really good spec to actually automate that task and save yourself the effort of going through it manually. Why not have the computer do it?
Exactly. So now that we know why, what are the things you should automate on the front end or as a developer?
I kind of have had this mindset for a while that if something's worth doing, it's normally worth doing repeatedly and continuously. So this is where you see the continuous methodologies like continuous integration and continuous deployment come from. Things become better and less painful the more you do them. So really, a really simple example would be things like, if you have a code style guide that you're meant to stick to, you should automatically enforce that all of your code either follows this guide or throws errors when you don't follow this guide. I spent quite a lot of time looking at different kinds of coding rules for a variety of different projects. And we basically came to the conclusion that rules that can't be automatically enforced are largely pointless because they're so hard to actually pick up in PRs and you tend to miss them and just scoot around them anyway.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea, and I agree because I think nowadays when I do code reviews, I would say that all the trivial stuff, like all the styles and everything, is automated to the extent that we actually end up discussing on something else than nitpicks, and I think that's kind of even a good heuristic to think that, is there something that we should automate in our workflow? If you do code reviews, those are a good place to see what sort of questions and what sort of comments we have here. And if you realize that you have any sort of nitpicks, you're missing something here, this sort of technicalities, then for me, it means that you're not automating stuff that you should be automating. So you mentioned code formatting.
Mm-hmm.
What tools should you use?
So I guess we're a big fan of Prettier at Supermetrics, and I've used Prettier a lot before. The reason I like Prettier is it's very simple. You can very quickly make a JSON configuration, and this is something that you can then turn into an NPM module and have all teams and all repos share incredibly easily. Second to Prettier, I also do a lot of work, especially in automation in Python, and there my absolute favorite is Black. It's a great formatter because it has no configuration. There can be no argument with Black because it just does what it's going to do and you can't fight it, which I kind of like as an interesting method, sort of a philosophy for a tool.
I think that's where Prettier started, but mm-hmm. I think it has something maybe 5 to 10 configuration flags because they didn't want to fight about whether or not you should use double quotes or something. Why I think Prettier is such an exceptionally good code formatter and how it, from my perspective, changed the game is that the result is always the same. So the previous generation of code formatters, if you'd run them twice, you first run the tool and then you run it again, you could get a different result. But 99.999999% time with Prettier, you get the same result. There are some edge case bugs, which I haven't actually never ever encountered, but I know that there can be. So I can't say that it's 100%, but from my perspective, it's in practice 100% of the time you get the same result. And what it means is that for the first 2 weeks, you will be annoyed because the tool is, pushing something to you that you don't want and you can't affect it. But once you get used to it, it means that the team no longer talks about the style of the code. And the second important part for me is that it has a limit for the length of the lines. So it enforces the hardest formatting places where you usually could have differences are those when people need to split things into multiple lines when the arguments are too long or something. And Prettier doesn't have this problem. It does. It has a strict rule and it follows it once the line is too long. So
I think
I'm curious, does Black do the same?
Black, I think, yeah, it does do a line length. I'm now thinking whether that's one of the few configuration options you may actually have because there's the 80 character people and the 120 character people. But yeah, it does that as well. I think one of the things I was also going to throw in that I really like about Prettier is that it will never change the meaning of the code. Mm. So, for example, I may be wildly wrong here, and I apologize if I am, but I had some interesting experiences when I was writing some Go code where it very nicely cleans up your code for you and deletes unused imports, for example. But I'm kind of addicted to pressing Command S all the time and saving every time I'm typing. So I'd find that I'd do something at the top, write a function or import something from another file, ready to use it later. I'd save, and then it would handily format that out because it's no longer being used. So I like that Prettier can be trusted as you can happily have that as on your on save hook, and nothing bad will ever happen to you.
Yeah. So I think that brings us to like we can go forward to other tools. Like, okay, so there's the code style, so how it should look, but then there are like other rules, like should you use any with TypeScript, or that you should not spread props on components with React. You shouldn't have unused imports. Like, that's something that you can automate. So what tools can you use for this sort of, like, that is not strictly code style, but rather some other rules, but they relate to, like, to your code?
So for TypeScript, we normally reach for ESLint, which is another great tool. Very good at finding all sorts of interesting issues, and will just nicely highlight everything in red and yellow and complain at you. So we use ESLint in all of our TypeScript projects right now. And we're starting to tie this in closely to the CI process as well. So where I'd like us to get to, we're not quite there yet, is that right now, if you have any ESLint violations at all, they actually get, it fails the CI pipeline, basically. First, the projects I've started implementing this with. But we'd like to move it for some of the more legacy code bases that will have a number of issues, moving to a no new issues kind of quality gate on stuff in CI, which I think is a really great way of getting started. Because, you know, the first time you bring in one of these tools, it's going to highlight a lot of your code base. And it can be quite intimidating when you have 20,000 violations and then you change some code and you add one more. It's very, very hard to actually see, did I just add one more, or was this always there? So hooking this up with some external tooling as well is actually a really good way of both automating the collection of this data, but then a bit of automated analysis will help you work out, did I make the code slightly worse or did it get slightly better?
So by not introducing new violations, you mean that you kind of save the state of the 20,000 violations that you already have, and then when you run the tool, it will only like make sure that like you're not making new violations, which yes, allows you to kind of introduce the tool to the code base step by step.
Yeah, this is absolutely great for legacy code bases where you have hundreds of thousands of lines of code and it's unmanageable when you have that many issues. But yeah, having this kind of making things not worse is a really good, I think, process to have when you're developing a legacy code base. Like, it's not going to be perfect. We know it won't be perfect, but just don't make it worse than it currently is. And hopefully, if you're actually having good CI and good automation of software metric collection, you'll see the number of issues slowly trending down over time. And it's quite pleasing as a dev to be able to look at the history of your code and just see that it's getting better and better over time.
So can you name any tools that kind of, I think ESLint, like by default, doesn't have this sort of a...
No, so normally you end up using this with an external tool. So one of the ones I've used a lot is SonarQube, which has a sort of enterprise editions. But we've actually done pretty well in the past with just the free version as well, where basically it has a load of pre-built linters sort of included along with it. But you can also just import any data you like at all from any tool, from basically any tool can import into SonarQube. So we've done all sorts of weird, interesting tools when I was working on embedded systems, hooking those up. And ESLint would work the same. You can just basically import a JSON file of where the problems are. And then you get a nice little dashboard to track over time.
Okay, yeah. So SonarQube, we'll add a link to the show notes. I think another tool, I think it's a Node.js tool. I'm not 100%. I think it works with ESLint. It's like Betterer. Mm-hmm. So the idea is to make the code base better step by step, and it has similar functions. If I remember correctly, it might use Jest kind of snapshots in a similar fashion that Jest does. So, but the basic idea is the same. So you save the state and make sure that, you know, the errors don't grow. That's kind of like, I think always with this sort of major changes in the code base, like the question, like, how do you deploy stuff with Prettier? If you don't have like 100 open PRs at the same time, you can just, you know, do it to the whole code base because it's fairly simple. But with ESLint, you probably have these sort of kind of rules that are meant to improve stuff the way, and those are, you cannot enforce those, all of them at least. Some things like no unused imports. ESLint does have an autofix that you can run reliably for the whole code base. So some of those errors you can get rid of like in a snap, but then the rest of the stuff you need a tool like this. Okay. So now that was about formatting the code and the code style. So if you have some sort of a style guide that you're trying to follow, you can use these tools to not nitpick on your code reviews. Or I would say that you can use these tools to actually really enforce the rules, because otherwise you're not, you know, someone is going to miss something somewhere and you're not really, you know, following your style guide until the tools actually do it for you. What other kind of automation there is related to software development or front-end development in general?
So I think one of the very major topics, and actually is a job for a lot of people, is automated testing, right? And right. I think for me, one of the most interesting things to think about with automated testing is if you're moving from a more legacy kind of approach where you have manual testing is great and has its place, but you shouldn't think of automated testing as taking manual tests and automating them, although that certainly can be part of it. You should also see that there are so many things you can do with automated testing you could never do with manual testing. So if you ever come across fuzz testing, for example, which is on a simple level, that's just taking a whole load of random inputs and shoving them into your functions and into your program and seeing if anything breaks. So, you know, let's take 50,000 different values and put it in this function and see what happens. This is something you would never want to do manually, but automation makes this happen, you know, in seconds. So why not try it?
And I think like, so we have like different levels of automated testing. So like you have like the most basic form that maybe most people are familiar with is unit testing. So you do it with tools like Jest, or with React, with React testing library or Enzyme, if you want to render the DOM nodes. Then you have integration testing, where you take multiple different, you know, maybe you run something even to an API, or then you have like a bigger component that takes multiple components and you make sure that they work together. You can use the same tools as you can use with unit testing mostly, like even like with React or with the front-end projects. And then you have E3 testing, where you go through the whole stack. And then there you also have multiple options. What's your experience? Like, do you have a heuristic, or how do you think about it? Like, if you would need to test a React application, like what testing tool strategies you'd have, or which one of these sort of, would you do fast testing for a React application? Or like, how would you efficiently automate the testing of a React application?
So I think sometimes it kind of comes down to what state are you currently in? You know, do you have tests? Is this an old project that has no tests? Is this a new project? I think unit tests are great, but I think they're largely great as essentially a dev tool to do as you run through. Writing unit tests for old code is incredibly hard often, and also is sometimes of mixed value. So I'm not a big fan of taking a project that has no tests and trying to write unit tests for old code, although sometimes that is useful. I think you get most of the value where you write the tests either first or at the same time as your code, depending on exactly how you like to do dev. And it gives you so much more confidence in the code you're writing that it's actually vaguely correct and doing what you expect, and helps you come up with the spec as you go. So I'm not a huge advocate of test-driven development or BDD, but I do like some of the concepts from it. I do like to try and test and code at the same time. So I see unit tests as like a dev tool, more than a test of correctness, mainly as a dev tool and to stop regressions, which is obviously one of the other huge benefits of having a good unit test suite.
Yeah.
But E2E testing, I think, is the... If you can get it set up and you have a reasonable environment, so this is one of those things. I think the difficulty of E2E testing is like strongly affected by exactly what it is you're building. So, for example, I spent a lot of time working on some Android apps, and a lot of E2E sort of standard frameworks were closed off with us because of the kind of app we were building. And this meant that E2E testing, it was very valuable, but it became a huge, huge project, and we spent a lot of time and a lot of man hours on it. But if you're building a more kind of standard web tech just a normal React type script, just going to run in the browser kind of app. I actually think E2E testing is a lot easier. There's a lot better frameworks out there. And it's an incredibly quick way to go from, I have no tests at all, to, okay, let's make sure that at least a user can log in and can do the main function that our app has to do. These kind of smoke tests, so just, you know, you flick the switch and does it explode into smoke or not? These are, I think, one of the quickest ways to get some value out of testing is just have this run in CI every single time that you're going to go through a build or a PR. Just make sure that you haven't completely messed it up.
Yeah, that's actually like the most high value test that you can have is like to make sure that you didn't miss like the whole thing up or mess the whole thing up. Like I have like this heuristic for E2E tests like that. Like you should start by asking what is the single thing or, you know, the first like three things that come to your mind that can never break, like should never break. For example, I worked with an e-commerce app. So there, the first flow that you need to write a test for is like, I can buy a product from this store. It doesn't matter which product. It doesn't matter, you know, with which payment method. Like, but there needs to be a flow where I go to a product, I add it to the cart, I go to the checkout, and I'm able to go through the flow and I get order confirmation. Like this is the thing that can never break. It doesn't matter. Like it does matter, but it doesn't matter as much if the descriptions are not showing. Like in a way, because you can still buy the product if you want to. But that's like the first thing, and I think it helps a lot. And in general, I think the React testing or actually the testing library, because it can be used with kind of all front end applications, has this principle that the more your tests resemble the way your user interacts with the app, the more confidence the tests will give you. So I think this is a kind of a good approach. Like if I would test this application manually, like what would I do? Like that's kind of the first step. And once you get kind of into testing and learn more, you can, you know, go deeper and find like, for example, stress testing, fuzz testing, and performance testing, like that some apps are very performance critical, so it might be worthwhile. Okay, so, and I think a thing that is related to, at least for me, to automated testing, and actually I recently listened to a full stack radio podcast episode that had like the topic was TypeScript and testing. And so I think one way to automate stuff is TypeScript. And that I think we should talk about it a little bit. Why do you think, like, what benefits does TypeScript give you in terms of automation?
So I think a large part of the automation benefits of TypeScript basically come down to the fact that you have a static type system, and actually a very good static type system, in my opinion. I think it's some people don't like it that much, but for me, it's very, very practical. And basically, by enforcing type information and like encoding this into your app, it makes it so much easier to change things later. And I mean, yes, both refactoring becomes easier because it's more explicit about what is being used where. And, you know, let's say I decide that I'm going to change the type of an argument, and you get this automatic kind of backup that, oh, you can't do that because later on you're needing it to have this particular type. So it kind of saves you from messing up manual refactorings. And also it basically increases the power of tooling to do better automated refactorings to make sure you really did get all of the places that this function was used on rename or things like that. Also the documentation, like JS doc is great and it's a good format, but it's incredibly painful going through a code base. And then you realize that the manually written documentation and the actual types expected by the function have kind of diverged over time. And TypeScript nicely just takes that out of the way because you write it once, you have a single source of truth, which is the TypeScript types, and then all documentation should be generated off that as much as possible to save this case where things start diverging over time and people get very confused.
Yeah, so you have like these two like benefits. So automated refactoring, in a sense that it can, because things are statically typed, it means all that your IDE or editor is able to find, like, for example, all the usages, or that that you're able to when you make a change, you're able to automatically see all the places that changed. And then there's the part where you document, like when you write the types, you're writing documentation on like what arguments, like not what arguments, but if you have an argument called product, what should be in the product, what you're expecting. And so that's valuable. So you basically create like documentation automatically by writing it, but you get the benefits. So I think that's valuable. I also think it saves you from some unit testing. Like it gives you some guarantees that help you like to not test stuff. And this is actually discussed in the Full Stack Radio episode. I'll link it in the show notes so people can go and listen. It was a very, very good episode.
That's fair.
And I think there's also kind of like the question of, now you have all these great tools, how do you make sure that people use them?
Well, like, obviously, the best way to make sure people do something right is to give them no choice. So this is why we have CI set up.
So what does it mean that you have no choice?
So basically, if things are automated to happen, you know, automatically, there's no human choice there of do this or don't do this. It'll just happen somewhere in the background. So this is why things like CI and having hooks on save and hooks on commit locally are so good. You don't even have to think about it. You know, I should probably remember that every time I'm going to commit some code, I should probably run the unit tests to make sure I haven't broken it all. But also I'm a human and I make mistakes and I forget to do things. So why not have that pre-commit hook there that's just going to run the test just to make sure that everything's okay? You know, what if I am relying on manually building my bundle and I'm going to check that into Git? Well, let's say that I kind of forgot to rebuild after changing some source code, and now I'm pushing something that I don't think, I'm mistaken about what I'm actually pushing to the server. It's nice that CI can actually just take that thought away from me. And why should I ever build my own code? CI will do that for me automatically, and it will, well, I guess it can be wrong, but it has a much less chance of forgetting to rebuild after a code change compared to me, who is probably like drinking a coffee and looking out the window at the same time as writing some code.
Yeah. And like things like one of the projects that I worked with had two commands. So npm run built the non-production bundles. And then you had npm run build dash prod that built the production bundles. And it can be sometimes hard to see from the Git, like the diff, that whether or not this is the production bundle or not. And there are times like when you just write npm run build, and then you're like, oh, am I shipping? Like, where is it going to be made sure that this doesn't get to production? It might not be a huge catastrophe, but it depends on the situation. So there were two kind of concepts, continuous integration. So you run things automatically, for example, when you make a PR. And then there's the continuous deployment part where you build the production bundles and stuff like that automatically. Like if I described like the like my current flow, like how things, like how I'd build these things, is that I usually have like an a tool that runs prettier on save. So in my IDE, I have configured that when I hit save, code gets formatted. And also ESLint is run automatically. So that sort of checking is done automatically. Then when I do a commit, there's a pre-commit hook that will make sure that that prettier is run for all the changes that I've done, and also make sure that ESLint is run for all the changes that I've done, if I've edited them with an editor that didn't do it for me or something. But the thing with pre-commit hooks is that they guarantee nothing, because you can always write dash dash skip pre-commit checks or something. I don't remember what it is, but you know, or ignore, whatever. But there's a command for, you know, to skipping them. So in order to actually not give people any chance of missing, you need to run them when the PR is done, and the checks need to kind of inform you that, yes, this PR is good to go. Or if you use a different kind of a flow, like Garrett, whatever, there you don't have PRs, you have just changes. But for every change that you do, those tests need to run automatically, and the tool should not allow you to, it should not allow you to do stuff before tests go through, before the all the checks go through, or at least depending on the situation where you're at or your code base is at least they should make it very, very hard to deploy something before the checks check out.
I will admit, on the latest jobs I've been building for our CI setup, there is a backdoor force option. But I think if you find yourself doing this, this is for, you know, the system has failed and it's 4 o'clock in the morning on Saturday and you just need to get this to work now. I think arguably this is the kind of thing you should set up with a retrospective. If you've ever had to press this force button, there better have been a very good reason. So you should probably have a retro on it and work out how to not do that again. Because at that point, you know, it's like you're taking your seatbelt off and winding down the window and hanging your body out the car while you're driving it, just going, okay, we'll be fine. What could go wrong? Turns out everything can go wrong quite easily.
Yeah. Yeah. And just one more kind of ready-made tool or tool that exists for automation that I want to cover here is that code mods. Have you ever used code mods?
I actually haven't. So I'm interested to hear you talk more about them.
Okay, so code mods are like there are tools for JavaScript and probably other languages too. But the basic idea is that they allow you to to work on the code transform your code on the code syntax level AST. So like is whatever some three, but basically the idea is that you can write transformations for your code that are guaranteed to, you know, do the same stuff for the, for example, same for specific variables in the code. For example, I wrote a code mod that removed the prefix I from all the interfaces in the code base. So you can do stuff like this automatically. So you can say, write a script that, you know, the tool parses all the JavaScript for you, and you can say that when you encounter an interface, if it has a prefix I, remove it. And this can be like a very useful when you're kind of doing this sort of big migrations. And for example, React, I think it publishes code mods for a lot of the changes that, you know, if there's kind of a deprecation or something, you can actually get a ready-made code mod from the React devs and just run it on your own code base to do the same stuff. So just something that is worth noting, that this is possible and you don't need to regex or something that's not really a reliable way of doing stuff.
Yes, in the same way, there are some very, well, I guess there are quite a lot of tools that do this, but it's actually been quite an experience. There are certain linters and checkers. I think there are some of the work for TypeScript and JavaScript too. I've seen them more in C and C++, but things where you can basically query the AST. So, I mean, there are all sorts of, we're talking about like linter check rules and stuff, but there are some very nicely configurable tools out there where you can just do really simple stuff. Be like, okay, I'm looking for a structure that looks like this, you know, where there's a particular thing which can't have this name and can't have this thing nested inside it. And you can write really quite in-depth checks for things that may be quite specific to what you want. So I guess I've seen these used a lot for like automotive industry kind of checks, when you have to do really quite rigorous checks that you're not doing particular styles of code and you're not using dynamic memory, say, in particular places. These are like really powerful tools based on the AST.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually I just remembered another code mod that I wrote a few years back. It was to convert all the snake cased variable names to uppercase. So which is a good example. You can say that if this is a variable, you know, you should run this simple transform on it, and you can be sure that, you know, you no longer have snake cased names or something in your code base. Okay, so there's a lot of kind of ready-made tools that you can use, but what about when, you know, you have something that doesn't have a ready-made tool, or you know, it's maybe not worthwhile to try to find a tool for that specific thing, but you still want to automate it. Like, how would you approach it?
So I guess this is kind of where the fun begins for a lot of developers, because this is when you get to get out your favorite scripting tools. You got to be careful not to I think many devs actually reach for scripting earlier than they should do, because you know, you're presented with a new problem that you want to automate, and you think, oh, I know how I could do this. It'd be really cool if I solved it in this way and then did this and then did this. And actually, if you Googled, you'd find that there was a tool that already did it, or someone has a GitHub project that you could just clone and use. So I think for me, that's always the first thing, is like, I'm just going to double check that no one has already solved my exact same problem, because often they have done. But if they haven't, then I feel entitled to have fun and write some scripts.
I'm actually like from the kind of the opposite end. I feel that like it took me quite a few years on the job to kind of get to this mentality that I should start actually, you know, solving stuff by automating it. So, but I can understand, like, there's even the, I think, XKCD legendary comic strip where there's like the two graphs, like how you think your automation project is going to go. And then the second picture where the reality is that you no longer have time for the original project when you're trying to automate stuff. So mm-hmm. I think this is all, of course, this is something that where you need to have some like, some experience on when you should really not automate stuff. But like my heuristic is to say that, hey, the right side to wrong here is to write a few scripts that you should have never been written, because that's the only way to gain experience. Like mm-hmm. if you never start writing those scripts, if you never try it out, you will never be able to tell like if it would have worked or not. So the only way to get this sort of intuition, like this sort of experience on when should I write automate stuff, when should I write scripts, is by doing it. So but if you find yourself doing it like all the time, then you might, you know, need some self-reflection. Like that the world might not need all the scripts that you're willing to write.
I think that's a good heuristic, because I was trying to think about this. Has there ever been a time where I spent a lot of time automating something and then thought, oh man, I shouldn't have done that, I wasted so much time? And honestly, I can't think of any example where I've regretted automating something. But on the other hand, I can think of many examples where I thought, oh, I'm only going to do this once. How are you? It's going to be annoying and boring, but I'm only going to do it once. And then you do it once, you show it to whoever's asked you to do this task or asked you for this feature. And they say, oh, that's great, but couldn't you just tweak this small part of it? And then you think, oh, I've got to go back and do it again. And if only I'd spent that little bit of extra time automating it, this would be a 5-second change one line of code and press the button again, rather than I'm going to spend 2 hours going through an Excel file poking at cells or something.
Yeah. And I actually think there's like this value also in if you kind of codify some things that you've, the steps that you've done, it's also like, now or later, it's easier to discuss on like what you're actually doing. So, but like, what are some good examples of like things that you've automated, like with good custom scripts? Like, where is it useful?
So I guess the main place that you'll find yourself needing to use custom scripts is where there isn't a, as you say, like there's no out of the box solution for the exact thing you want to solve. But often you'll find that there are tools that do a little bit of the job, or you know, so, you know, maybe you have to do some data transformations, and there's a tool that can get you the data, and there's a tool that can visualize the data or push the data onto where you need it. But there's just a mismatch between them in the formats they expect. And this is kind of a really good chance for some scripting, where you just need to do some really simple data transformation. I mean, it's often going to be XML or JSON or something like that, which are very easy to work with. And if you're like me and you're a big fan of Python, this is a great tool just for, okay, I just need to write a really small command line script that's just going to process some data really quickly and shove it onto the next one. But in terms of like more concrete examples, I guess the kind of things I've done, I think a really good example is when I was working on this Android app. It was kind of a weird one in that it had to lock the phone down, this Android phone we were working on, and made sure it was the only app that could ever be present on there, which actually made it very hard to uninstall the app and also to install it. So there were a whole load of ADB, which is the Android device bridge, which is like a command line tool for just saying, move this file to the phone, force install this, force uninstall this, reset, whatever. And you'd find that every time you wanted to test your changes, you had to do about 4 or 5 commands waiting for each one to finish because they weren't that quick. And this was just a really simple case of, okay, I should just write some bash scripts around this. And then once you had those, you realize actually, wouldn't it be nice if this could, we could kind of pass information between different scripts, and then they became Python scripts and functions that started passing information around. And it went from, you know, it was a huge pain to install the app to test it. And then you think every time you'd install something and you think, oh man, I forgot to include the latest change, or I need to change one thing, and now it's gonna take me 5 minutes to uninstall and redo it. It's just, it's no problem anymore. I just run my script and go and grab a coffee. And when I'm back, I'm ready to go. So I think that's a very good example of something that didn't take long to automate, but saved me a lot of time.
Yeah, so just simple Python scripts and huge benefits. Like I've mostly written, I think this sort of kind of maybe command line tools or scripts with Node.js. So there are a few packages that you can use to kind of have this command line interface. You can have even like an, because usually when you write a script, that, or at least often, you might have like a file that you want to input or something. You want to configure it in some way. I've used it like, for example, getting some like, not one-off data, but sometimes like if you'd need something from an API for maybe mocking or something, but you need to transform it. So I've written scripts for this kind of stuff. If I've done some sort of one-time data migrations, even if it's not like the front-end stuff, but on the front-end, you're sometimes on the back-end, and then you're sometimes working with data. Node is easy for me because I use a lot of JavaScript, so it was very natural. And I think like the most important thing is like Python, like if you're familiar with that, that's good. Like, but in most of the cases that we're doing, like it doesn't matter, like in terms of performance, like if it's Python or JavaScript, you know, if you want to use Go because you're a better person than everyone else, then, oh, that's Haskell actually, but sorry, but you know, but whatever, like, I think the most important thing is that as a developer, you should have at least one go-to option. Like, because if you don't have a go-to option, you won't do it because the barrier for doing it is too high. So I think it's worthwhile to practice, like at least in some language, write a single like command line script. Maybe it takes something in and takes out. And I also think it's worthwhile to write at least one code mod just to see like the power that you get with a code mod. And also ESLint rules. I think those are things that you should, like custom ESLint rules is something that's, you know, if you're thinking about how can I improve my automation foo, there are a lot of things you might want to kind of enforce in your code style, but you don't have a ready-made rule. Making a custom ESLint rule will solve that problem for you.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It largely does not matter which language or tool you use, but I think the most important thing is to use something that you're fluent in. You don't, like, I wouldn't, for most automation tasks, I don't use it to learn new things. I'm not going to go and find some interesting language or framework that I want to learn. This is where I just want to sit down. I don't want to even need to Google anything. I'm just, you know, there's like the shortest distance between brain and code. You're just smashing it out as quickly as you can to see if you can do this thing. Because, you know, sometimes you start automating, and as you start planning it out, you're going to realize that actually this is harder than I thought. And here is the gap that means this can't be automated. So if you thought, oh, hey, I saw there was some really cool library I want to learn, and I've spent 2 hours learning about it, and now I've started automation, and you think, oh, okay, actually, this was pointless. Like, it's like a lot of programming. You learn small chunks of functionality. So you have to pass JSON one time and you have to manipulate it. And then you learn a few small tricks that you're going to reuse later, these building blocks. So some things that I kind of identified as like common building blocks for scripting would be, yeah, basically handling things like JSON and CSV and XML. You're going to do a lot when you're doing data transformations. The ability to attach a really simple CLI on the front, so a command line interface, is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. Maybe not so much when you're using it yourself, but when you're, you know, the person sat next to you says, oh, hey, that looks cool, can I have the tool? You don't want to have to go, oh, okay, and then, you know, the first option you provide is this, and the second option is this, the third. You want to have a CLI you can just whack on the front to make it easy. You know, hitting requests, very important. You need to use APIs. Visualization and things like that and data manipulation are incredibly useful. Just, you, yeah, with experience, you get used to all these little tiny building blocks, and it can become very, very quick to go from, I have some automation task in front of me, to, okay, here's the prototype, here's how it works. Is this worth continuing? I think also a final thing I'd like to say on this is, it's kind of, this is one of those few times when you can get away with being messy as a dev, because a lot of what we do as developers is engineering and making sure things are standardized and readable and maintainable. And I'm not saying your scripts shouldn't be maintainable, but for me, this is one of those few areas where you can get away with just, you need to hack something together to make it work. And you can, it's kind of more allowable to, you know, you don't have to use a particular framework or, I don't know. I'm not really sure.
But I actually agree. I agree because scripts have usually fairly simple like inputs and fairly simple outputs or something, you know? Mm. So you don't change them like that often. I agree like that. Like this is something where you can just, you know, hack something, and that's pretty much the most important thing. Like that, this is not about perfection. This is about doing something faster than you'd doing, or more reliably than what you would do manually. And you can, in most cases, you can, you know, you don't need to write tests because you can manually verify. Like you do it so rarely that the work that you need to do for manually, you know, verifying stuff is quite low. Mm-hmm. So absolutely. But like, just write some scripts. that's the tip. So I think there's like, we need to wrap this up. So there's a lot of kind of good tips, and I'll add links to everything on the show notes. The one last question before you go, James, is that what resources would you recommend to someone who wants to go from good to great as a front-end developer?
So I think we discussed this a bit offline, and I guess the thing I realized, I'm maybe not the best example of this. So I'm more of a doer than a planner. So my favorite way of learning something new is honestly hop on Google. I'm Googling technology, then getting started. Technology quick start, technology best practices, get together a few good articles, and then just choose a small, simple thing that I can hack together. Ideally, something I already know how it works. So a classic one I quite like is Game of Life. Game of Life is complex enough that you have to learn a few different things. You have to use a few different features, but it's not so complicated. And if it's already a problem you solved before, you don't waste any of this effort kind of thinking about the design often. It's more about, how do I do it with this technology or with this library? So that's what I like. I like to choose a small, simple project, get my initial set of articles, and then just get down to it. Let's start hacking at the code.
Yeah, but like it might sound obvious, but I think it's really worthwhile, like, just to, you know, make sure that when you're starting something, is there prior art? Like it doesn't necessarily mean installing something from NPM, but it might mean taking the library and looking at it and see how they've solved it, and maybe you decide that it's not worth like having a dependency, but the solution that they've done will give you input on yours. So it's worthwhile to know the prior art.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. Thank you, James. And thank you for everyone who listened to us or watched this podcast. And we'll get back to you in a few weeks.
All right. Thank you.